Pomerim, hello friends. Yeah, there you are. How's everybody doing today? Excellent. So if you haven't noticed, it's almost summer. You know, we're at the end of May, and the definition, the reason they call it May is because it may be 90 degrees and it may snow. You never know in this month. That wasn't my joke, just it only gets worse, though. No, so end of the summer, or end of the winter, we're moving into summer, means wedding season is upon us. So we have gone to way too many weddings in the last number of years. Sonia has like 50 first cousins, so that means like every other weekend there was somebody getting married at some place throughout the Midwest. We put on a lot of miles, saw a lot of nothing as we drove back and forth. But we saw a lot of weddings, went to a lot of weddings. And I heard about a wedding this week between two pieces of bread. That's right, two pieces of bread got married, and it was a lovely service. The reception started out, it was also going really well, all until someone decided to toast the two pieces of bread. Yeah, that's... No? What did you hear about the wedding between the two antennas? The service was great. No, the service was bad, but the reception was amazing. That was, all right, yes. I should have stopped with it may rain, it may snow. So we're not talking about marriages today, but I thought that kind of fit because when you get married to someone, all at once these two families are joined. You are welcomed in, I hope welcomed into another family. They welcome you in, you welcome them in. Your aunts become their aunts, your uncles become their uncles. You are connected with people through this relationship. And I think that's a helpful understanding of what it means to be a person of hospitality, to be a person who welcomes the stranger in. So what we're going to do today is we're going to look at the story of Lydia. It's probably a familiar story, but it's a short story. We're going to walk through this story, try to understand what's going on in the background, and then we're just going to try to get a better concept of what it means to be a person of hospitality. We're going to look at biblical examples of hospitality and how both we as a church can be more hospitable and how we as individuals can be more hospitable. Can we handle that? Excellent. All right, well then let's go ahead and jump right in. So this text for today, it comes from the book of Acts. We've been working through Acts ever since Easter. And we're going to have two more Sundays from Acts. It'll take us right up to Pentecost Sunday. So we're working through Acts, and you know that Acts is a book that talks about how the message of the kingdom of God through Jesus Christ has been expanding and getting larger and growing. We've seen barriers that have been breaking down, walls torn down. Last week we looked at Peter. And Peter dined with Gentiles. And for us, it's like, okay. Like, what's the big deal there? No, it was a huge deal because there were these social taboos that said you don't even sit with a person who isn't a part of the Jewish faith. Now, all at once, to be able to sit with a Gentile meant that they were a part of the family. Barriers are torn down. So that was Peter. And then we pick up on the story of Paul. If you look at the New Testament, you will find, especially in the book of Acts, that Paul goes on three clear different missionary journeys. Three different missionary journeys. So a large trip where he leaves home, goes around different countries, different cities, preaches and teaches and establishes churches. The first missionary journey, you ready for this transition? You should be watching. You ready? I set up the curtain transition because it was cloth. If I have to explain it, I know. It's not the same. First missionary journey, Paul takes with him a guy named Barnabas. And they also have with them a guy named John Mark. John Mark is believed to be the guy who wrote the book of... Yeah, that's a tricky one, I know. Book of Mark. Ooh, the book of Mark is named after his last name. Which is weird, because who else has a last name in the New Testament? Jesus has? No, it doesn't. Anyways, John Mark is the guy that wrote the the book of Mark. And Paul and Barnabas, as they're setting out for their second missionary journey, that's actually the fight they have about whether or not they should take John with them, John Mark. and Paul and Barnabas go their separate ways. First missionary journey. Second missionary journey, which begins just before our text today, Paul picks up a new running partner, a new entourage. Now he's got a guy named Silas that's running with him. And not only Silas, they also find a young man, a Greek guy named Timothy. But if you read through this passage today, you maybe didn't pick it up as Sonia was reading it, but there's this, the second person plural, first person plural, is used repeatedly. They talk about the we. So who is the we? I mean, is it just like French for yes? Like we. You want to go on a journey? We. No. Not even funny. No. Who is the we? Well, it's probably the author of the book of Acts. We know that to be Luke. So first missionary journey, he takes the author of Mark. The second missionary journey, the author of the book of Luke and the book of Acts goes with him. So they go on these journeys. They're teaching, preaching, establishing churches, and just spreading the good news. Now, our text for today begins with this vision. You see, Paul is all about going from city to city, town to town, and he decides he wants to go to a certain place. And it says in the text just before our text that he was prevented by the Spirit of Christ from going into another city. So he has it in mind he wants to go to Harrisonburg. He's going to go to Harrisonburg to preach and teach the gospel. And for some reason, God says, no, you're not. God prevents him from getting there. And it made me think the next time that you're on 81 and you're trying to get somewhere like Harrisonburg and there's that traffic accident, maybe it's just God saying, whoa, you don't have to go there today. That's not in my plans. What we see instead is that God has a different goal for Paul. Rather than going this way, he's given a different vision to go that way. In our text for today, we find this. Paul is sleeping, and he has this vision of a man. He has a dream, and it says in this dream vision, come over to Macedonia and help us. And Paul wakes up from this dream, and all at once he just starts packing up his stuff. He gathers his companions, gathers his entourage, and they head to Macedonia. He sees this as God's clear teaching on where he should be and what he should be doing. No, don't go to those other cities. That was blocked. The traffic jam was in place for a reason. Instead, go to Macedonia. And don't you wish that your dreams could be discerned that easily? Don't you wish? Like, I have the weirdest dreams. Like, I wake up and I'm like, oh, what was that dream about? Like, here I am juggling chainsaws while riding bareback on a giraffe across Antarctica. Yeah. It's like, clearly I'm supposed to join the circus in a cold climate area. I don't know what that means, but Paul wakes up and he knows what he's supposed to do. Go to Macedonia. And I'm making a big deal about it for a reason. This is a big journey. He's not just going next door to the 7-Eleven to grab a loaf of bread and a gallon of milk. He's actually getting on a boat, and they are sailing across the Aegean Sea and going to a new continent. Macedonia is in modern-day Greece. And when Paul and his companions leave their city, wherever that was they started, Sonia had so many big words and names in that text, I don't even know where that is. But they left this one area, and they went across the sea, and they become the first missionaries, the first people to bring the gospel to Europe. And it seems like kind of a big deal to me, the first ones to come into that city, into that continent. So verse 13 of our text tells us that when they arrive in the city of Philippi, it's a city within Macedonia, they arrive at Philippi, and normally Paul's routine, if you think about it, where does Paul usually preach and teach? He goes into the synagogues. That's where he teaches. He finds people who are of Jewish persuasion, and he would teach them about how Jesus was the Messiah. But if you look at verse 10, he didn't go to a synagogue. He went down to the river to pray. That's why we sang that song this morning. They went down to the river to pray. So what does that tell us? One, that means there probably wasn't a synagogue in the city of Philippi. And for there to be an established Jewish synagogue, that meant there had to be 10 male adult Hebrew people, Jewish people, in the city. So if there were not 10 people, the people who were followers of God would gather together in random places to support one another, to pray for one another, to essentially have church. So what that tells us is the city of Philippi is a very Gentile-dominated area. There are not people of Jewish persuasion. We read this passage. He went down to the river to pray, and he finds some people there. And do you notice anything specific about those people? They're women. And what about that last list I had up there? Those were all men. And, you know, it's kind of weird now. Let's be honest. If I just go up and start talking to a woman somewhere, it's kind of weird in the 21st century sometimes because, you know, there's some issues there, some taboos. But in the first century, you don't do that. More taboos fall. More barriers are torn down. Paul and his friends are speaking and teaching these women about the gospel of Jesus Christ. And as they're having this conversation, one specific woman comes up and she seems to really be moved by what they're saying. Her name is Lydia, and she's said to be a follower of God, not a God-fearer, which is the normal language that's used for somebody who is a non-converted Jew. But somehow she's been exposed to the message of the Hebrew God. She has learned about the God of what we would call the Old Testament. She's a kind of a believer. And God moves her to accept this message from Paul. And it says that Lydia and her household are baptized right there at the river. So what do we know about Lydia? Not much. There's the one thing we all know. What was Lydia's job? I want to hear what Casey said back there. Hospitality, excellent. Maybe I shouldn't have brought that up. No, you're ahead of me. Her job was she sold purple material. And it seems like a very specific job, doesn't it? Like, wouldn't you want to branch out a little bit? Like, why just purple? There's so many other materials to sell. Like, if you're on the street corner selling purple material, excuse me, would you like to buy purple? Like, nope, not really my thing. Like, I would think you would do better if you branched out a little bit. You know, there's throw some reds in there. Maybe a couple yellows. You want a few blues or periwinkles? Like, I tend to get a little crazy. I'm wearing some checks today. Like, branch out a little bit. You know, I'm a big fan of khaki. Why just purple? Well, we know that purple has symbolism behind it. Purple is the color of royalty. So all y'all out there wearing purple today. looking hard, all right. Or royal blue, it counts. You are royalty to us today. Only the richest and most powerful people could afford purple garments. Think about it like this. What materials would have been available in the first century for people to have clothing made out of? They probably had access in the southern parts of the world to cotton. They would have had certain kinds of linen, flax, and wool, maybe leather, if they had enough money. And if you wanted to have an outfit, and like your clothes were going to be what? Like linen color. They're going to be flax color. Like, you want brown or light brown? You want a little variety? If you want a little variety, then you have to have those clothes dyed. You have to do something like grab a bunch of berries and mush them up and boil it down, put the clothing in there, let it soak a little bit, and dye your woolen vest or whatever it is you decide to wear. But the color of purple was hard to come by, especially that deep, dark, royal purple that they used. There was only one place that you could really get that color that everybody wanted. You know, it was that in color, the cool color. All the royalty were wearing this deep, dark purple. And you know where you got that deep, dark purple from? Sea snails. I know, right? There's something about that in my mind. Like, you have the fanciest, most expensive clothing, and where does that come from? Like the lowest thing one of the lowest things on the food chain. And not only is it like a lowly creature, it also would have been ceremonially unclean for any Jewish person to handle. I don't know if you consider a snail like shellfish or not. We'll go with that. Yeah, you're a biologist. You could. I got confirmation from the biologist. Yeah, it's like a shellfish. So it's considered ceremonially unclean. Jews to this day will not eat escargot because it's unclean. clean. So this is what you have to do. You have to boil down sea slugs to make this cloth. And the reason that any of this is important is because this shows Lydia's status in this culture around her. Lydia was rich. Lydia had money. She was powerful. And look at this story again. When we talk about all the things that are noted in this passage, note what's not listed here. There's no man. There's no husband. Women, this is empowering, right? There's no husband listed here. She either was not married or she was a widow. She wouldn't have inherited this business from her parents because if she was the only living heir, it would have gone to somebody else instead of being passed down to the women. It's the way it was. I'm not saying it's right. The only way she would have acquired this business is either she got it when her husband passed away or she built this thing up from the ground herself. And there's no reference to her husband. There's no reference to her being a widow. No reference to her children. This right here is a self-made woman. A business owner. A powerful woman in the first century. And she is the one that it becomes the first convert to Christianity in the entire continent of Europe as we know it. Still something cool about that. So as she is baptized, not only is she baptized, but her servants are baptized because she's powerful. Of course she has servants. Her household is entirely baptized right there. And then we read this in verse 15. When she, that's Lydia, and the members of her household were baptized, she invited us, that's Paul and the companions, to her home. If you consider me to be a believer in the Lord, she said, come and stay at my house. And she persuaded us. Think about all the barriers that have now fallen. We have the Jew-Gentile barrier. That's been broken. We have the male-female barrier. That's been broken. We have the rich-poor barrier. That has been broken. All of these barriers torn down. Now the gospel is not just this parochial thing for this small group of people. It has exploded even into another continent. Barriers breaking down one after another after another. So when I think of Lydia, I think about all these barriers that are broken. But not only that, I think about what she did with her money. I think about how she used that. We talk about her being this dealer of purple and how she likely used shellfish to make her purple cloth. But she was not shellfish with her money. Never disappoints. So when I think of Lydia, what do I think of? Casey, what did you say earlier? We think of hospitality. And the thing about hospitality is it's one of those words that, like, I don't even really know what it means. Like, what is hospitality? I think I know it when I see it, but I don't know how to define hospitality. When I see Lydia telling Paul and his companions, you know, Paul, Silas, and Timothy and Luke, all these people, inviting them into their house to stay and live and eat their food, eat her food. You know, I get upset when my neighbor eats a lot of my food. All these four men coming into her house. She's inviting them in and they're eating her food and using her facilities. That is obvious to me. That's hospitality. When I think of hospitality, I think of hotels and restaurant business, the hospitality industry. Giving someone a warm bed and a hot meal. That, to me, says hospitality, sharing something with someone else. But I also realized just doing that, that's not really hospitality, is it? Like, I could give you a key to my house and say, sure, the bed, first door on the left, you can stay there. Or I could set down a plate in front of you and say, here's a sandwich, and walk away. And that would be kind, but is that really hospitality? Don't think that's quite what the word is getting at. So to understand what hospitality means, I want to do a little bit of looking at how hospitality is portrayed in the Bible. We'll call it biblical hospitality. I know, a creative title. What is biblical hospitality? And I'm not even coming up with this on my own. I'm making fun of how lack of creativity, how it lacks creativity. This is actually coming from a professor, Scott Cormode, from where did he teach? It doesn't matter. From Fuller. He's at Fuller. That's right. A little California love. He's from Fuller. I quoted Tupac. All right. Little California love out there in L.A. At Fuller. He teaches biblical studies, and he wrote this article on biblical hospitality. So Scott Cormode at Fuller University, at Fuller Seminary, out in California, he gives some examples of what hospitality looks at. And there's things that I necessarily probably wouldn't have thought of on my own. For instance, the first thing that he notes is God placing humanity in the Garden of Eden within God's creation as an act of hospitality. Think about it like this. Who created the heavens and the earth? God, yeah. Who do the heavens and earth belong to? God. And God created us, human beings, put us smack down in the middle of God's creation, God's possession, and said, treat it like you treat your own stuff. Treat it like you treat it your own things. Like, what's mine is yours. You are now stewards of my creation. That is clearly an act of hospitality. But hospitality isn't just somebody that has a bunch of something sharing with people that have less. It's not always the Lydias sharing with the Pauls. Sometimes we have examples in the Bible where it's somebody who has very little and they share of that little. He gives the example of the widow of Zarephath. It's a fun story, this widow story. Elijah, the prophet, in 1 Kings chapter 17, there's this drought, this famine going through the country. And Elijah is traveling. He comes across this widow, and he says, he says, give me some food and water, because that's what you do. He sees this widow. He asks her for bread. He asks her for water, but there's this drought. She has nothing. She has very little. And I love her response because it's just like so real. Here's what the widow of Zarephath has to say when Elijah asks for bread and water. She says, I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little olive oil in a jug. I am gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son that we may eat it and die. So I like this story because, one, we know that she actually opened her house up to Elijah. And he lived there for a period of time. We see him coming up in later passages as well, living there with the widow and her son. He stays with them. She provides hospitality toward him out of her little, and God provides her with more. This olive oil and flour continues to feed the family for a long period of time. But the thing that I really love about this isn't just that she's providing out of her little, it's that she's like being real with him too. Being hospitable doesn't mean you always have to be cheerful about it, but you do it anyway. Anyhow. Next one. Go to the New Testament. We find Jesus sending his disciples out in Luke chapter 9. And there's all sorts of examples of hospitality in the New Testament. Jesus is eating at people's houses. He's staying with them in their homes. And in Luke chapter 9, he sends out his disciples two by two into the world. And he doesn't say, here's your per diem, you know, spend it wisely. He doesn't say, pack all these things, prepare for this trip. Make sure to weigh your luggage before you go to the airport because they'll charge you extra if it's more than 50 pounds. He doesn't say any of that. What's he say? Take nothing for the journey. No staff, no bag, no bread, no money, no extra shirt. Whatever house you enter, stay there until you leave that town. Jesus' disciples in this story are to rely upon the hospitality of others. They are going out to spread the message that Jesus is the Messiah, and they're supposed to just go and rely on the hospitality of the people that they're preaching to. And this is interesting for me because it made me think of one of the best known passages of hospitality. If I say the word hospitality, some of you probably thought of this passage as well. If I say, what is the first verse that comes to your mind when we talk about hospitality? Anybody have any guesses? I was counting on Marlene. Thank you. Makes me think of Hebrews 13 too. About entertaining angels. And here's the thing. Hebrews 13:2 says, do not forget to show hospitality to strangers, for by doing so, some people have shown hospitality to angels without knowing it. Now, you've heard this before, but I'm going to make it even more weird for you. We come for the weird, Pastor. Make sure you put a comma in there. We come for the weird, comma, Pastor. We come for the weird, Pastor. Children, punctuation is important. Where were we? The weird thing about this word right here, angels, can be understood in different ways. The challenging thing when you read these passages, the word in Hebrew and the word in Greek, both words that we translate as angels, can be understood as these heavenly beings that come to us and speak to us and protect us or whatever it might be. But angels can also be human beings that are messengers from God. The Hebrew word is malach. Everybody say malach. And the Greek word is angelos. Angelos. A little more California love. Los Angelos is the city of angels. These words can both be translated simply as messengers. And they are at times in the New Testament and the Old Testament simply used to describe messengers. For instance, there's one book in the Old Testament known as Malachi. Malachi simply means my messenger. The way we discern whether this is an angelic being from heaven or a messenger from earth is the context clues. If this creature has wings and flies about, messenger from heaven. If it's like Paul or Barnabas or like the disciples that were sent out two by two who are messengers of God's word, it is a earthly messenger. So when we look at that passage from Hebrews 13, which is it? Is this an earthly messenger of God that we're entertaining or a heavenly messenger of God we're entertaining? And I want to say, I don't know. But the point that I think we can get from these stories about Jesus sending out his disciples and the entertaining angels is that when we open up our homes to other people, we are at times supporting the very message that God has for the world here. Now we're working toward one more example here, and this is the big one. This is the one that really gave me some inspiration. I think really gave me a new understanding of hospitality. And that's the one we're probably all thinking of. It's, of course, from Leviticus 19, 33 and 34. One of our life verses, right? It talks about welcoming the foreigner among you. The alien. Roger loves that translation. The aliens living among you. We come in peace. Leviticus 19, 33 and 34. When a foreigner resides among you in your land, do not mistreat them. The foreigner residing among you must be treated as your native born. Love them as yourself. I've heard that before. I think Jesus said something like that. For you yourselves, you were foreigners in Egypt. The thing that this author does that I really like is he says that hospitality is about giving the things that we enjoy as a part of an insider group to those who are on the outside. It's about treating the strangers among us, the foreigners among us, the aliens in our midst, as if they are family. Biblical hospitality is treating a stranger as if they are part of the family. Now, what does that mean? I think that means whenever you're at Walmart next time and you see some stranger going up and down the hall, up and down the aisles, that you invite them to come over for lunch, right? Maybe not. You can say hello. There you go. But I do think that we as a church and we as individuals can learn something from this. So I started asking myself questions like, how can we as a church practice hospitality in such a way as to treat people as if they are already insiders, already a part of the family? And when I thought about this, the first thing I thought of was my friend Isaac and a story that he likes to tell. So Isaac is, he's my age. He's actually 2 weeks older than me, and I don't let him forget it. He's 2 weeks older than me, but he comes from a very different background than I do. He has Christian upbringing in a charismatic church and Catholic tradition. His family comes from different backgrounds, so he's charismatic and Catholic. And he went to divinity school at a United Methodist school. So here he is, a charismatic Catholic studying at a Methodist school. And he picked up and moved from one part of the country to another part. And as he started divinity school, he did what most people do. They decide to go around and look at different churches. You do a little church hopping, a little church shopping. It happens when you go to a new town. You just want to find, where do I really fit? So where does a charismatic Catholic studying at a United Methodist seminary go to try to find a place where they fit in? Well, of course, the obvious answer is to go to a small Mennonite church that meets in a Presbyterian church building at 5 p.m. on Sunday. That's what you do. So my friend Isaac walks into this church, this small church, meeting at 5 p.m. in a Presbyterian church. He'd never been in a Mennonite church before. This is his first experience at the Mennonite church. And he found it very welcoming and engaging, and he loved the community. And as he's having a conversation at the end of church, he's talking to this guy named Tom. And Tom is just this loving and caring individual. And as Tom and Isaac are having this conversation, Tom says to Isaac, "Will you read scripture for us next Sunday?" And Isaac's like, "I didn't know I was coming back next Sunday." Gotcha. You are now, right? And he continued to come back for 17 years. He's concluding his time as the pastor of that church this summer. Pretty impressive story. Now, it's very extreme. Like, I had never thought of inviting somebody the first Sunday here to read scripture next Sunday. But it made me think of my practice. When we have people that are newcomers in the church, I tend to give them no responsibility whatsoever for as long as possible because I want to serve them. Come, take a part of our community, but we're going to do everything for you. And I just kind of was struck by this passage, like maybe that's not what real biblical hospitality is. It's not about doing stuff for people. When you have a member of the family here, families pitch in. Families help. Now, I've been here in, you know, less extreme kind of situation where we've had people that it's like their first or second Sunday here, and we had a carry-in meal, and I've seen people over washing dishes. And like, "I don't even know your last name. I'm not sure I know your first name." And they're participating. I think there's something beautiful about that. Because too often the church has become just an extension of the world around us. And the world around us is very consumeristic. What can I get from you? What can I buy from you? What will you give me? Feed me, even the church. I'm coming to be fed and to be nourished. And there's good things in that to be nourished. But it also has to go the other way. What am I giving back? Biblical hospitality involves something going both ways, treating people like family. So what does that mean for us as individuals when we leave this place? How do we practice hospitality? I think one of the first things that we can do is just be aware of people's particularities and try to be accommodating to people. I know some places that word is a bit of a no-no. We don't try to accommodate. That sounds like we're giving away our core beliefs. No, don't sacrifice your core beliefs. I'm not saying that. Like if you have somebody coming into your house from a different religion, that doesn't mean you have to erect an altar to Baal in your living room. But if you have a Jewish person coming to your house, maybe you don't serve pork chops that night. You try to be accommodating in that way. If you think about somebody's dietary needs, maybe you make a special meal because someone's vegetarian. Or you're aware of any like allergies they may have. Maybe they're gluten intolerant or they have a nut allergy. Trying to just be aware of that is, I think, an act of hospitality. It's saying to somebody, "I care about you, I care about your life, I care about your well-being, and I want to make sure to provide something for you." And it's a way of treating somebody just like family. Because if I had a family member, thankfully nobody in our family has any allergies to food. But like if one of my kids was allergic to peanuts, I wouldn't serve them peanut butter pie. Why? No, because I don't want to go to the hospital that day. No, you care for them. You reach out to them. You learn about them and provide for their specific needs. You accommodate their needs. That is an act of hospitality. All right, I need to wrap things up. So we come back to this person of Lydia. This person that we know very little about other than that she's a powerful woman, independent woman, self-made woman. Well, we come to the end of this chapter and Lydia comes back up one more time. Some time has passed. Paul and Silas have been in prison, you know, like you do. And after they get out of prison, this is what we find in verse 40. After Paul and Silas came out of prison, they went to Lydia's house, where they met with the brothers and sisters and encouraged them. Then they left. I love that. In case you were wondering, then they left. So what do we call it when you get together with brothers and sisters and encourage one another? Fellowship? I was looking for the word church. We call that church. That's what we're doing now. What we see at Lydia's house here, not only is Paul the first one to bring the gospel to Europe, not only is Lydia the first convert to Christianity in Europe, Lydia starts the first church in Europe. And do you remember what city Lydia was living in? In Philippi. And there is an entire book of our Bible, the book to the Philippians, addressing the church in Philippi, the church that may have been the same church that was started in Lydia's house. Think about all the things that are connected to this one woman. Because she reached out and shared from her abundance with Paul and his fellow missionaries, the gospel was planted there and spread, and we are receiving the fruits of that today. I don't know what will happen if you are hospitable. I don't know what's going to happen if you go out and welcome somebody to your house to eat a meal, spend the night, whatever it might be. I don't know what will happen. Nothing is guaranteed. But I think at the very least what we will see is that someone will feel loved and appreciated. And if that's the very least that happens, that's not a bad thing. At the very best, we're going to entertain angels, messengers of God like perhaps Paul and Silas, people who are going to go out and plant churches and share the gospel broadly. Let's pray. God, thank you so much for the challenge